Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right Senator Dan McKay. Welcome, Dan.
Good morning, everybody.
And on the political left, Councilwoman Shireen Gourvani. Welcome, Shireen.
Hello. Hi to our listeners as well.
I hope you two are staying safe. It is the week of weather in the Salt Lake Valley and also all around the state. I guess it's been bad up in Logan. I don't know how far south it's stretched, but we got wind. And it just takes 2020, and let's count it. You got civil unrest. You got a public health crisis, economic recession, earthquake, fires, and hurricane-force winds. Dan, you've been counting it on your fingers. Give us a report from your nest.
Well, and you forgot to acknowledge snow in September. I mean, we've got snow in September, and I'm saying, screw you, 2020. That's exactly how I feel right now. Just, you know, it's starting to feel like, what else, right? And that's kind of what 2020 is becoming. So,
yeah,
hey.
Yeah. Shireen, I know I'm going to a city level here, but I think of Mayor Mendenhall, who became mayor of Salt Lake City. And then look at what she's had to deal with. Unbelievable. Yeah. There's no rest.
There is no rest. Certainly a trying time on many fronts. And as a person who is definitely starting to see some messages around just what's happening right now in this moment with massive trees down, massive power outages, I will just say Salt Lake City is putting out excellent information, but it's important for people to know if you do have trees blocking roads. I think at this point, by the time you hear this, hopefully most of those are cleared up, but you need to call your city. If they're on your property, then the trees are your responsibility. So I know it's trying. It's hard for people. And I've been getting sweet messages from people trying to volunteer, trying to figure out how they can help. But it's a real mess in Salt Lake City today.
Shireen, let's stay with you for just a second. This feels like an extreme weather event, right? Because you've got snow in September, these incredible winds. It speaks to a changing climate. And I'd love to hear your comments there. And then we'll go to Dan.
That's exactly what it is, right? We're going to be in for more of this extreme swings in temperature. Certainly, I think many of us were lamenting, even mourning the extreme smoke that we were experiencing. I know I had a little bit of a scratchy throat the last couple of days just dealing with unbelievable smoke coming in from California fires and some of our own as well. There is a really terrible consequence to long-standing inaction. Some of the things, especially around the forest fires that we're experiencing, have to do also with people making terrible decisions. The vast majority of the fires that we've seen in this state were lit by human caused, you know, error, including two of our largest fires this week that were from people at gun ranges, you know, and that is devastating. The amount of just sheer taxpayer dollars that go into that. If people were outraged about what they saw with protesters damaging property, they should extend that same outrage to what's happening and the danger that we're putting our firefighters and first responders into when it comes to our wildlife management and our fires.
Dan, let's pull you into that conversation.
You want to talk about a group that owes everybody an apology? It is the uber left agenda of, you know, we're going to take care of the earth at the expense of human balance. And you see this playing out, and I'm glad that Shireen brought it up, but you see this playing out in California, right? The policies that they push in California are clearly not solutions for the rest of the world, because the state is doing a bad job of forest management. And as a result of their tree first, people last mentality, as far as how they balance the global warming and the global climate change issue, they are seeing record number of fires. This is the worst year on record. And it is and it shows no sign of changing. And so what I think this really requires is a focus on a dual effort of trying to look at ways that man can stop, but also the ways that we can intervene in things that nature's causing, because we are doing far more damage to ourselves and our environment by the fire seasons in California than most of the cars in the rest of the country will contribute to pollution for the rest of the year.
So I think that's just really like unreasonable propaganda, Dan, because I do actually most people agree that there has to be a dual approach. And we are seeing a similar uptick. We don't have this same scale of forest land management that we are seeing in California, but we have issues with our fire prevention here. And a big part of that, too, is generally efforts around fire suppression have been largely defunded. Like, we have not gotten the help that our Forest Service needs, that our parks and open spaces, our wilderness needs. So there really needs to be, I think, a large effort here. And most people would agree on that.
Perfect. I think you are making the clearest argument for why the federal government should stop managing Utah's public lands and why Utah should instead be focused on managing those lands in a way that's responsible, because you're absolutely right. The federal government has done a poor job of balancing that effort, regardless of who's in office.
I love it, Dan. I feel like not only is it a propaganda today, but it's also a hearing problem, because I do believe that the federal government should invest in that way.
Hey, fantastic.
Hey, so just the political middle gets a voice here. I just have to say that one of the great innovations of the Utah Roadmap, which was a product that came out of the Kim C. Gardner Policy Institute, so I'm talking about our own work, but we recognized the interventions that help with air quality that also help with a changing climate. And that's where you can find the biggest common ground to make some good things happen. And of course, one of the most important ones is how we use our automobiles. So there's some things that can come. Hey, Dan, you were not able to join us last week. I wanted to get your take on former governor John Huntsman deciding not to do a write-in campaign. He had to make that decision by the end of August. He opted not to do it. So it looks like we've got Chris Peterson and Spencer Cox as our two big candidates. What's the take from your vantage point on why Huntsman didn't get in, or how this all sort of plays out?
So I know this will sound somewhat tangential. I met a guy last week who ran and swam and biked 50 Ironmans in 50 days. The guy's from Utah, okay? 50 Ironmans in 50 days. The coordination and the physical stamina it takes to do that. Honestly, I think that might be easier than running a write-in campaign.
Oh, that's the connection.
Because I will tell you, the write-in campaigns are hard to execute for many, many reasons. I have in my life on a statewide election only known one to be successful, and that was Lisa Murkowski, senator up in Alaska, ran as an independent after she lost the Republican nomination and then ended up winning a write-in campaign. Now, granted, the population of Alaska is less than the city of Salt Lake City. So it's a little bit easier, really, to run a statewide election in Salt Lake City. That said, I think as you look at the legacy of the governor and Governor Huntsman and what he did, and as he looked at his policy differences with Spencer Cox and, you know, with the Republican nominee and the Republican ticket, I think he did the analysis and said, you know, the cost benefit of doing this, there are probably other ways I can contribute, and I'm going to focus on those instead of spending the time doing that. But it is going to be, I still think, an interesting race this coming November. Will Spencer and Deidre get over 70%, maybe 75%? These are the questions the voters want to know in
Dan's he's giving you trouble there, Shireen. Shireen, we have about 20 days until the Utah Debate Commission debate for the gubernatorial campaign. You spent some time with the Democrats on this side. I guess they were happy to not see John Jr. get in. You know, the rumor was that he was going to pick, he was going to change his running mate and run with Greg Hughes as his running mate. I don't know if you ever heard that. That was the rumor. Dan, I don't know. Was that the rumor you heard?
I had heard similar rumors. Yeah. And I can say that there probably were serious conversations about that. But knowing Greg, that was not going to be an easy convincing for him
to do,
despite his feelings. He is a diehard, I'm going to support the Republican nominee and move on. And that's where he is.
Yeah. Shireen, give you a chance to comment from the left.
Yeah. So I think it's hard anytime you have to draw a distinction between multiple candidates. So I think for the Democrat and the Republican, just to kind of have each other is easier as a candidate, right? But one of the things that I'm concerned about is that we're not seeing much from candidate Spencer Cox. It's been a long time since he's tweeted anything original out of that, Cox for Governor Twitter feed. I don't see much in terms of the campaign. I understand a lot's going on, but I think voters deserve more of a message about where he's going to take us, what his vision is for the future of the state. And I think people should take a hard look at Chris Peterson, who is a phenomenal candidate and brings a lot of expertise that's going to be important as we're thinking about where our state's heading and how we're going to come out of COVID.
54 days till the election. I'm Natalie Gochner. I'm with Dan McKay and Shireen Gurbani. Stay tuned in our next segment. We'll talk about some more local political news.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gurbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. We ended the first segment talking about the Utah governor's race. Chris Peterson, the Democratic candidate. Spencer Cox on the Republican side. Chris Peterson's making some news, Dan, because he's encouraging the state auditor, John Dougal, to make sure that he releases his findings on the no-cost, bids, no-cost contracts in the early days of the COVID-19 crisis. Did you follow that news, Dan? Anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, the audit is an important part of, reviewing our processes and making sure we're, doing things the way we're supposed to in state government. I do think it's a little bit ironic that the Democratic nominee for governor wants to politicize state audits and, hopes to shortcut the process somehow. To try and use whatever comes out of the audit to his advantage. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting take, really. I'm not really sure that's the best way to improve state government by getting involved in campaigns, but this isn't the first and it probably won't be the last request to do something like that.
Shireen, my concern here is that when you see the results of the audit, it will be hard to replicate what it felt like in those early days of the crisis and the weight that was on the state shoulders trying to compete for personal protective equipment or whatever it was. But I would love to hear your thoughts. Dan basically called it politicizing.
Yeah, I think voters deserve to know. And we've had many questions about this. As you remember, the detailed reporting, in particular on Test Utah, which made national news in terms of the way that response was highly concerning. I think the huge amount of money that was spent on the app that was supposed to help track and provide information. I think the way that people felt like they were being monitored when they came into the state and got a text alert. Many of these things deserve to be examined and I think should be a part of a deep dive in terms of where we're going and what kind of response we have in a crisis. Mm-hmm. Understanding the way that people make decisions in that framework is important to thinking about who we want to lead this state. Mm-hmm. So whether or not I would say it's, politicization of an audit, I do think it's important for all of us to be thinking and reflecting on how decisions have been made, how executive leaders are making decisions in this time, how they're communicating with the public about it. And, if it exposes mismanagement of funds or insider deals or whatever that might be, that we should know. It would be nice to know before we vote. But I think more importantly, I think it's really important to inform us going forward on some really big and difficult decisions. We might experience something this extreme again, and it would be nice to know that we could learn some lessons.
Yeah. Dan, you could think of it as politicizing it if it was not released by mid-October. Just another way to think of it.
Sure, yeah. Sure. And I would say, and to your point, Natalie, it is going to be hard in that process. And I use this analogy, I've had my boat break down in Lake Powell before. And it cost me a fortune to have someone come sole source and pick up my boat and go get it fixed, right? And in that scenario, I wasn't in a position to be, negotiating or, trying to find strength through price concession or that kind of thing. I just needed the work done right away. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be almost impossible to go back, put ourselves in that March situation and try to undo or redo some of those situations that I hope for another 100 years, nobody else has to deal with.
Boy, same here. Hey, Dan, I want to stay with you just because this you're always so up to date on these sorts of things and you had to vote on it. But we've been learning the term ballot harvesting. It's the collection of ballots from voters in bulk by political operatives. We took action on this in the legislative session. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, you know, the ballot harvesting is one of the concerns for, you know, mail-in voting and where the mayor, you know, where the ballot is mailed from. And it looks at propensity of how likely it is to be Republican versus not Republican districts. And, you know, how do you, you know, fix that ballot harvesting? And then you also talk about, you know, harvesting itself is like where the voter fills out an absentee ballot and, you know, they don't necessarily complete all the security checks or whatever it might be. So their ballot might not count that way. And so there's a bunch of stuff like that. And then can somebody who's 90 years old and doesn't frequently go out to the post office for health reasons or whatever, can they give their ballot to somebody else to then take it to the mailbox and drop it off? Mm-hmm. And some of those, it like in Utah, you know, that's not a problem. In other states, it is, and it's against the law. You have to actually physically put your ballot in the mailbox. And so all of that stuff is really where we're trying to protect or prevent or avoid, you know, voter fraud. And I don't think anybody really is interested in voter fraud, although obviously the biggest solutions, you know, that no one wants to talk about apparently is, you know, having stronger voter ID laws, you know, with, you know, voter identification, that kind of stuff. Of course, that's unreasonable.
Yeah,
you know, we wouldn't want to go that far.
Shireen, were you supportive of what the legislature did this session in clamping down on ballot harvesting?
Yeah, so I believe that it was a pretty reasonable response. So I have to say, I didn't actually find out what the final articulation of that bill was. So I'm not in a position to speak to it. But I do know that one of the common issues that comes up, I think, as you suggested, Dan, it's pretty easy for most of us to just drop it in our mailbox, or we've got a number over 20 ballot drops around Salt Lake County. But on native land, it's a really different story. We have people that aren't addressed, right? We think about the just the COVID numbers on Navajo Nation and thinking about getting your ballot in, getting it to a post office. And so making sure that there's some sort of way for people to get their ballots in. And I believe the bill ultimately accounted for that. But it can be a real challenge, especially in our rural communities.
Yeah. Shireen, we have to get to President Trump here. And he did something at a campaign stop in Pennsylvania. He said to the crowd and got a lot of enthusiasm for it that Mitt Romney couldn't be elected dog catcher in Utah. And just called him home of our worst senator. And then he clarified that that's Mitt Romney, not Mike Lee, whom he praised.
So I don't know that anyone can be elected dog catcher in Utah. So just so we're clear, that's fake news. But I continue to be disappointed by the rhetoric of this president. I find him to be just so deeply disrespectful. And I'm so ready for this administration to be over.
Well, Dan, what'd you think of the dog catcher comments? I mean, I, you know, you and I have a long friendship here, and you know what a fan I am of Senator Romney, and he's like this voice of reason nationally for me. I wish there were more people that would jump on his bandwagon.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting swipe that the president took at Mitt Romney. It is like,
why?
You know, it just shows you that there's deep animosity between Senator Romney and President Trump. This is not the first time a senator has not gotten along with a president, and it won't be the last. It is interesting, though. I do think Mitt Romney could be elected as dog catcher in half, maybe two thirds of the counties in the state of Utah. But I would say there's probably a solid third of the counties in the state of Utah that he wouldn't be elected right now as the dog catcher. So, you know, if that's an elected position, I guess we can have that conversation later, which it is actually more commonly an elected position back east, but it isn't. They started it. This will be boring, but they started it as an answer to the spoils system to try and get rid of it. But I've now bored everybody. But the idea that the dog catcher would be elected in Utah is quite cool. and I'm now considering running for that. So there we go.
Okay, me too. Let's go. We'll have to decide.
Shireen, let's hear your take on President Trump's troubles with the Atlantic magazine and his reportedly calling soldiers losers and suckers, and this continuing theme that he doesn't support our men and women in uniform.
Oof, yeah, this one was terrible, and it just hit me in such a dark place. I think that there is a just pattern of behavior that this president has when it comes to the just person-to-person respect for people who have served this country. One of the quotes was that he was, standing with John Kelly at his, I believe, son's grave, yes, and just said, like, I don't get it. Why is this happening? Or, like, why would anyone do this? And I think more broadly, we saw quite publicly his disdain for John McCain, his lack of respect for his service in that way. So few people, frankly, serve this country in this capacity. And it serves us all to give them the respect that they deserve for being willing to lay down their life, mm-hmm, for our freedom, for what this country represents, what it stands for. And I really have to say, this is one of the just really disturbing aspects of how he leads this country, because he certainly loves to use the military and was obsessed with these military parades to sort of prop himself up in a way that I think is reminiscent or calls to some, very troubling leaders in other nations. But it's unacceptable. And I don't understand.
Shireen,
I don't understand how he would not even just keep his mouth shut about it.
Are you troubled like I am by the unnamed sources in the article? These people got to come out.
And now there have been many that have confirmed it, though. So additional news sources have confirmed the same story. And certainly the stuff about McCain was very public.
Yeah, right.
So it is concerning, but there's also clearly a pattern of behavior here. And I think when people show you who they are, you should trust them.
Dan.
So I was just going to say, remember, The Atlantic is owned by Lauren Jobs and by, and I can't remember the name of the other gentleman.
It's been confirmed by Fox News.
But you've got two owners who are large financial contributors to Joe Biden's campaign, right? As their owners, one. Two, you're absolutely right. That article is a complete opinion piece without it being attributed to actual people, right? And if other news outlets decide to issue an opinion piece that's unattributed, then by all means, they can all have their opinions and do what they are. But calling it an article, is not what that is. Now, that said, does the president, have an issue with the military? I think if you look at how Donald Trump has acted and how he's attended military funerals, how he's been part of those phone calls, when you listen to staff members who have been part of phone calls as he's called deceased members of the military who've died in the service of the country, if you ask them about his respect for the military, it is overwhelmingly supportive. But by all means, let's trust a couple liberals who really love Donald or who really love Joe Biden.
Hmm. I want to just say from the political middle, I've been to several U.S. Cemeteries overseas, and it's one of the most sacred places you'll ever go to. I've been to the one in Belgium by the Battle of the Bulge. I've been to the one at D-Day, and they are very holy places, in my opinion. And so that was the most troubling part to me, that he would be not filled with the empathy and appreciation at those moments. So tough. Hey, we had one other Trump news that I just want to get before we go to gripes and gratitude. The U.S. has not only pulled out of the WHO, but they've pulled $62 million in funding from the World Health Organization. When I worked at Health and Human Services, I went to a Washington Wizards game in a box with people from WHO and got to kind of interact and socialize with them. During a pandemic, I don't like this, Dan and Shireen. I think we should be at
What's your concern?
I just think we should be at one with the world community tackling this pandemic.
Yeah.
But you look at being one and what it got us. Remember in January when the WHO confirmed with China's help and they said, there is no proof of human to human transmission This is not a threat. And right after that report, the president shut down travel from China, and everybody thought he was this terrible racist and was terribly, you know, acting inefficiently. And then, even after that, we found human transmission likely. In some ways, this 62 million and this response to withdrawing from the WHO, it feels like it's accountability. It's like, look, if you want to just accept the Chinese line and not investigate yourself, why are we involved in this organization when the CDC is far better and can publish reports and studies and give the information just as freely, and we don't have to fork over the extra money?
Shireen? So I'm going to slip in my gratitude for the WHO. As a Peace Corps volunteer serving this country in Moldova, I work side by side with them on things like educational materials, outreach on breast cancer awareness, HIV/AIDS work that was happening in Moldova. I know that that work is replicated across the globe, and it's going to be a real detrimental hit to global health. It's a problem.
And we're out of time. I'll just say congrats to BYU. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm with Senator McKay, Councilwoman Gorbani, and the program is produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everyone, for listening.